Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Asia House Bagri Foundation Literature Festival 2016. I would like to thank you all for coming today. My name is Jemima Steinfeld, and I run the literature program here. With the Literature Festival being the annual highlight, it's sponsored by the Bagri Foundation, so I'd like to thank them for their support. We have a really interesting discussion ahead. Food is, of course, not something that we eat just to survive, but something we enjoy, we celebrate, we bond over, we fight over. It separates us, it unites us. It says a lot about society. When I was researching the talk today, I actually asked my mother, who was sitting on the front row, who used to live in Israel. She lived in Jerusalem in the early 80s. And I said, what was it like living there when compared to Britain at the time? You know, what did you remember in terms of food? And she said, dill. She vividly remembers the smell of dill in Jerusalem. It was in the salads, the dumplings, it was everywhere. She had never tasted it before. She hadn't even heard of it at the time. It wasn't really available in the UK. Now, of course, dill is just a normal herb in any supermarket. So I think, you know, what does this say? She also remembers the bakeries, amazing flatbreads, sesame seeds, plaited breads. In England at the time, it was just normal loaves. So what exactly has been happening? Well, we have three fantastic speakers to tell us about this. Srebpaka and Itamar Strulevich are the owners and chefs at Honey & Co., one of London's most popular modern Middle Eastern restaurants. The pair met while working in a kitchen in Tel Aviv, and they later moved to London to experience new things. Itamar has worked as the head chef at Ottolenghi, and Sara has worked at Orrery around the corner. They're authors of several cookbooks, some of which have won awards, and one was named Cookbook of the Year in 2015 by the Sunday Times. In fact, today's event is a little bit earlier than our usual events because Sarah and Itamar have been nominated for two awards at the Fortnum & Mason Food and Drink Awards, and they have to rush off tonight.
Cross fingers.
So we're going to have about a 50-minute talk, and there'll still be some time if you want to buy books, get them signed. So talking tonight, interviewing them, will be Angelica Marlin. Angelica writes about food for The Telegraph, and she started her own very successful website called About Time. Angelica has just returned from a trip to Israel, where she wrote an article entitled, About Time You Discovered Israel's Best Dishes with Marta. So the three should have a very fruitful conversation. Please join me in welcoming them.
Thank you very much. So I thought we'd just start with the basic stuff. So Tel Aviv to London. Can you tell me a little bit about how that happened, how you ended up cooking in London?
You me? Well, we did not come to live in London. We just came for a couple of months. And our main idea when we left Israel in 2004 was that we said we're just going to travel around and cook all over Europe and sort of, you know, just learn whatever we can. And then we got to this country and we stayed a couple of months, and it took us actually a long time to get settled. And by the time, you know, it took us like 6 months to open a bank account and, you know, finding a flat and all these things. And then by the time we did have everything sorted, we just say, actually, this is quite nice. We don't need to go anywhere. And London is a great place, you know, to travel back and forth. You're quite close to Europe, you're close to the States, you're everywhere. So it's a good sort of base, and it's a terrific town. It's an amazing town to cook in. And so much has happened in that time, but it's a terrific town to cook in London.
So how long were you cooking in London kitchens before you decided to start Honey & Co?
Quite a long time. I'd lived here before, so my family are English that moved to Israel. And I came here to study chef school, and I worked here for a few years at the Orrery, and then moved back and met Itamar. And when we came back, probably about 8 years we were working for other people. Jay Sheik is the Oxa Tower, Ottolenghi, so we kind of like to work in the same places because it's nice for us. As chefs, it's the only time we get to meet each other, so we pretty much worked every place.
So I would always go to a job and sort of get the ground ready.
Source a nice job for me.
Yeah. and then Saeed will come 6 months later, she will get a better job. And then we'll move.
So you would lay the groundwork.
Yeah, I would lay the groundwork.
Warn everyone that I'm
reap the rewards.
Nicer later on in life, and then
It's quite an uncommon thing to hear, to be honest, because you often hear people saying that they wouldn't want to work with their partners all day long, and it's actually lovely to hear that that's what you prefer, is to be in the kitchen together.
Well, I think we met in a kitchen together.
Oh, okay.
Shut up.
So we're debating the point.
No, we're not debating point, really. But we met in a kitchen. It's kind of the natural... It just feels like the natural place, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think for us, you know, we are only ever comfortable in kitchens or at work or something like that. So it's very natural for us to...
And at home, we don't talk.
Yeah.
To keep it silent.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So you was it always the dream to have Haninko, to have your own restaurant? When you work in these kitchens for many years, was it always a kind of a pipe dream to have your own place?
It was his dream, not so much mine.
Yeah.
I wasn't very interested.
Yeah, I've always, you know, wanted, you know, or when I started this profession, I thought it would be nice to have my own place. But then as you work in actual kitchens or as you see how these things actually work, you realize, you know, how difficult it is to actually go and do it. So there was a point there that I thought it's never actually going to happen, and it was in a way a lot of luck that it did happen. I think there was...
How long was that process of actually opening the doors from having the idea?
Well, from having the idea, it's been pretty much since we've met, but yeah. Actively looking for a place about 2 years.
2 years.
We were quite lucky the only people that were lucky to have a financial downturn, because it meant that rents plummeted, and realistically, that was the only way we could get a property. So the restaurant we took was really an empty shop, and it had been empty because of the financial situation. It had been empty for about a year, so they were dropping the rent.
2011, 2012.
Yeah, so we were very lucky to be in that situation. We could just, because really we took a place that had kind of a functioning kitchen, and all we did was change the floors and open the door. So from actually getting the keys, it was 6 weeks till we opened.
Wow.
But about 2 years...
When you walked into that space in Moran Street, did you know it was the right one?
We did. Even though it was about the colour of this, about bright, bright orange with green furniture. And
sounds delightful.
Yes, yeah, it was stunning. It was a bit scary when we saw it, but the space felt very nice. And because of that kind of functioning kitchen and a beautiful cold room downstairs, like an old butcher's cold room, and we just said, yeah, we can open this really fast. Yeah. We can do something here. And it was never meant to be as busy as... Well, it's good that it is. I'm not complaining. But it was meant to be just a place where the two of us worked, no?
Yeah.
That's how we started. Both of us in the kitchen. I was doing some cakes. Ethan was cooking. Then he would go upstairs and serve customers. And I would go into the kitchen and serve the food at lunch.
But to be fair, we did place offers on maybe 10 or 12 other properties beforehand that didn't go through.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a love at first sight and we had to have it. We were just beggars. And this just happens to, it just sort of all the stars aligned that this sort of did happen for us.
Yeah.
But we would have gone anywhere, didn't we?
Yeah,
we've seen some dumps, I'll tell you this much. And we were crushed when we didn't get them. So.
Yeah. The restaurants that open now, I mean, now London restaurants open every week. It's an incredible kind of booming food scene. And it seems increasingly people are spending so much money on restaurants, making them opulent and beautiful and grand. And there's something in Haninko that is quite stripped back, quite simple. Is that because you felt it suited the style of food more?
Couldn't afford anything else.
So we didn't have any money. It was just our meager savings from working as chefs, which I tell you don't save much. And we couldn't afford
anything.
And
furniture
anything.
From home. Yeah,
yeah, it was furniture from home. It was, you know, we bought broken stuff from eBay. It's all our pots and pans from home. It's the one sort of splurge that we had is the floor tiles, which were kind of expensive. And then Sarit's sister gave us like £150 to buy plants for our little courtyard, and that's it.
Yes.
And ironically,
that's
all the charm of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. But I mean, we've changed quite a bit to the kitchen since, and quite a few things have changed. But yeah, I mean, we started really without a...
Yeah, so there was not a choice as such. We did what we could.
And so just to come on to Middle Eastern food more widely in London, when you first opened Haninko, what was the response? Were people quite receptive to Middle Eastern food, or were they quite unsure of what it was, really?
I mean, people were very receptive and very loving of the food. I think that for a while we had a few people that didn't understand what we were trying to do. Or, like, we never intended, for example, to put hummus on the menu. because we said you can buy hummus everywhere. You don't need to. We don't need to be making a version of it, and we want to do food that is different. But so many people would come in and just order it automatically. Not
just assume that.
Assume that if we're a Middle Eastern place, then of course we're serving hummus or. I wonder if there's anything else was like that. It was mostly with that, and we kind of started making it a bit as a joke because we kind of said, well, if everyone's asking for it, maybe we should make some, and then it's kind of become quite a big thing. But I think there's some understanding of what the food is, but a lot of what we do, the kind of, because we're trying very much to do the very home style food here, then people, it was quite new for some people.
Yeah, but I think, you know, Londoners are so, you know, we always say it's the best sort of customers that you can ask for, because people are so open and they're so looking for new things, and they're so appreciative of things like quality and freshness, and, you know, and they have the money for it. Not that, you know, we don't think that we're very expensive, but still, you know, people to go out, you need to spend money. And the crowd, the customers that we get are just, you know, they're just terrific. I don't think any town in the world have, you know, such excellent diners. I think this is the reason why London is booming so much.
But actually, one of the things that was really fun, or that really still excites us now, is if we get someone that comes from Turkey or Greece or Iran, or you know, we get from Kuwait, and they say, they taste something, and they say, oh, it tastes really like home, or it brings back all those memories, and you think it's such a huge pool of people that the same flavors trigger the same kind of thing. And we, when we were living in Israel, didn't realize how universal the food is.
Yeah.
How much it means so much to so many people. No?
Yeah. We had we have a couple of Yemeni girls that they come every Monday. And my family are from Yemen. I don't look it, but it's true. And they just, you know, we put some of, you know, the Yemeni recipes on the menu, and they order it, and they say, oh yeah, it's so nice, it tastes just like home. You know, you have to come and see, you have to come to Yemen, you love it, we'll show you around. And I'd say, you know, this was, I never thought that this could happen in a million years.
Yeah. And so the kind of food that you're cooking at Honey & Co, is it the kind of food you yourselves grew up with?
Not me. I grew up very English food. I grew up on chicken pies and, you know, boiled vegetables and stuff, because my parents grew up here and this is the food they cook. My mum's a very good cook, but English, you know, very English food, shepherd's pies and stuff like this, and that's what I grew up eating. And in restaurants we would go out a lot, so a lot of the Arab restaurants or the kind of Druze communities with people that my father worked with, you'd go to celebrations and you try a lot of food that is very, very different. And then later on, when you start going out to friends or start eating with friends or sleepovers, then I think that's kind of a unique thing in Israel, is that every, because there's such a large diaspora of people coming from a lot of different countries, you get to eat a lot of different foods at people's homes. And that opens a nice kind of eye into it, no? Yeah. Even, like now, I'll go, if we go home and we'll go to Itamar's mum and she'll cook something that I've never tried before, or how we do it. So it's nice to have that.
Yeah, there's always more sort of things to discover, more sort of recipes and dishes.
What's your first memory of food? Was it your mum that cooked at home?
Everybody cooked. Everybody cooks. I think my dad would cook. My first, you know, the first thing I remember is my brother used to, he said, oh yeah, I'll teach you to cook this magnificent dish. This is just, would take some chicken, put it with mustard, and put it in like a little clay toaster oven, and it would go black, and then we'd eat it raw inside. That's the kind of thing. But we would be cooking in the kitchen, all of us, all the time.
Yeah.
So it's, I think, again, in Israel, it's very much part of life, of everyday life. Everyone cooks. So you are exposed to it from a young age.
There is what people have been calling the Ottolenghi effect, that people have got a real increased interest in Middle Eastern cuisine and more of an understanding and appreciation for it because of him. How much do you think we actually owe to Ottolenghi for how we're now eating?
I think it's got a big part in bringing a lot of ingredients into people's knowledge. And it's kind of an egg and a chicken thing, because I think he started creating food that was very colourful and very vibrant, but not specifically what I would call Israeli when he started, I think.
Or Middle Eastern.
Or Middle Eastern when he started. I think it was, if anything, slightly more Italian, a lot of infatuation with very Asian flavors, actually. There was a lot of kind of Japanese and even Chinese influences. You know, there was a lot of use of noodles, of broccoli and chili and stuff like this. All these actual classics, I don't think are Middle Eastern. But this aspect of vibrancy of these large platters of the color, I think that made a big difference, and that's what people connected to.
And that sort of opened the window for people to say there's something new.
Yeah, and I think in it's gone very quiet.
Yeah.
And I think doing that, and the fact that he is very popular in the columns, and then starting to bring in all the things like pomegranate molasses and za'atar and stuff like that, has really opened. I mean, when we moved, you would never be able to buy za'atar in a supermarket. Mm. I mean, it exists almost in every supermarket now, which this you have to attribute to what he's done in terms of food writing and, you know, cookery books and everything like that. But he is maybe not the first one to use them, but he's definitely the first one to become very popular, which is, this is what you need, isn't it? It's someone that is a good face to the food, and he is charming and very handsome, so, you know, it's a it carries well with the food.
And I think that the, you know, the Ottolenghi food is such an appealing concept. It's such, it's so easy to love. And, you know, bringing that to people and opening up to people and you know, people get to engage with, you know, this Middle Eastern food in a different way, I think that's great. I think that's amazing.
How much do you think... how important do you think food is in actually how we see nations and how we see other people? People talk about Ottolenghi being able to actually give us an increased understanding of the Middle East. Do you think it's allowed kind of more dialogue about the Middle East? It's encouraged people to perhaps travel to the Middle East and be more tolerant?
I hope so.
To believe it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice idea anyway. It's nice to, we're not qualified to say what's actually happening on the ground. But it's much nicer when you say, you know, to talk about food than to talk about, you know, politics or whatever it is, or whatever the other connotation that you have for these regions. And you can say, oh yeah, we went to Jordan, we went to Israel, we went to Lebanon, we had, you know, terrific food, we had a tremendous time, and have that conversation instead of other conversation, you know, power to it, why not?
Mm.
Yeah. If this happens, it'll be, you know, the dream, no?
Mm. Amazing. In terms of trends, because it seems like Middle Eastern is called a bit of a trend at the moment. There's a shawarma bar opening in June that everyone's talking about. And also there's a big trend away from meat. How much do you feel like your cooking is affected by these trends? Do you listen to them? Do you kind of let them into your menus? Or do you just kind of stick to what you know?
We kind of stick to what we know. Mm. I think for us it was always about opening something that is very personal. And to just open food that we, you know, with food that we enjoy to eat, we enjoy to serve. I think coming to dinner at Honeyco is not very different than coming to dinner to our home. I think it's pretty close to what we would cook if you came for dinner. And that was always the idea, was to keep it quite
homey. The food that we cook is mostly very traditional, so sort of very old fashioned. But it is, you know, and we can't ignore it. We do respond to our customers. We do adjust recipes. You know, this is not the recipes that a housewife in Lebanon 200 years ago would cook. This is the recipes for London now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to tell with these things. It's hard to tell. We try to avoid, you know, being faddish, and we really don't like,
bless you.
You know, to think about food trends and things like that, because I think that sort of diminishes and creates a different conversation that we don't want to be part of. Also, you know, as when you run a business, that's a concern. You don't want to be
the next fashion.
The
one that you've lost. Yeah.
Yeah, but who knows? Time will tell.
Middle Eastern food relies so heavily on great produce. You know, when you go to Israel, you have an Israeli salad, and it's simple. It's cucumber and tomato, but it tastes incredible because of the quality of the produce. I've been to a lot of Italian restaurants in London, and no matter how good they are, they never come close to a simple kind of tomato spaghetti that you get in Italy, and they always say, well, you can't quite get quite the level. Do you find that a struggle in London?
Only in River Cafe.
So is quite good. Do you find it a struggle to find ingredients that really do your dishes?
It's really hard.
I think it's hard in certain things and really easy in other things. So the fresh produce, that's really hard. Coriander or parsley that smell or taste like what we get back home is very hard. Cucumbers, even worse.
No, we get nice cucumbers now, but not
not as nice though. Because trust me, I was just there. I ate like this is all I ate for. I was there for 4 days. I just ate cucumbers. But other things we get amazing, really, really amazing things because we get produce from the south of France, so Sicilian tomatoes, which are beautiful, and what you can get here, which is very hard. For example, in Israel, is all the produce that comes from Iran or from Lebanon. So tahini, we get a beautiful tahini and pomegranate molasses, which in Israel, that produce wouldn't arrive because of the political issues between. So actually, we get amazing produce because of being in kind of this very global central city.
Yeah. And we do sort of, we do get amazing British produce as well. We're getting pulses now that are grown
organic
in this country.
British pulses.
You know, fava beans that when we even when we opened, we were looking for a good supply, we couldn't open, and now they grow them here. Mm-hmm. We're getting tremendous, you know, British beef, Cornish fish,
lamb.
You know, lamb is stupendous quality, much better. So it's a balancing act, but you can get much better produce now than you could.
Yes, for sure.
When we came,
what are some of your personal favorite things to cook with at the moment?
Lamb always.
Yeah, artichokes are now big.
Yes, artichokes, broad beans.
So it's a way I get to do with the whatever I want with the menu. So we had a whole, you know, we had two starters, three mains with artichokes. And then you want to say, you know, all the upstairs, he was like, what are you doing? Crazy. I said, you know, now we're going to put it on.
I'm back now.
So
that and cheese, I think, you know. Nice goat cheeses or the kind of very creamy feta, we always like to work with that.
How have you found the experience of going from working kitchens to running your own? Is it difficult to kind of balance the creative side of what you're doing with actually the logistics of running a business? I know that's personally something I find quite difficult, is the idea of running a magazine is very fun and actually you can't do anything creative because you're stressed out about invoices and payments and all that kind of stuff. Do you find it difficult to kind of balance the creative and the business?
Well, there's two of us, you know, so we can sort of take turns.
Right now is quite a busy period and it is hard. It just depends because it goes in waves, doesn't it? We're kind of working on new projects, so it gets harder and busier. But other times we're like full of, you know, you're like bursting with ideas and you kind of run. And we have a big team as well now. So
an amazing team.
They're really good. And, you know, we work with, I think, more than 20 people now. So, you know, it kind of allows us the time to play with things sometimes.
I think it's a sort of start stop. You know, I could say, you know, we're working on a big project now, and then I could say to Sarit, look, I can't handle it. You know, that's the phone number. Deal with it. I'm going to the kitchen, or she would say, all right, I'm in the kitchen today. Leave me alone. Or we have that luxury.
I find being working for ourselves much more creative because I think. Your aim is to get something that is really going to be loved because all you want to do is sell food. This is kind of what we're doing. So it's so important the end kind of feel of what people are eating and how they experience it and coming back again. That's your main kind of objective with everything. So it really kind of gets the creative juices flowing in terms of wanting to kind of create something new or exciting. Or, you know, we have quite a lot of regular customers, so to change the menu so that next time they come, there is something new that they can try, but also a couple of old things that they can rely on being there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And actually, you need to be quite creative with everything that you do when you run a business in a way.
Mm.
You know, how you manage people, how you manage your suppliers. You need to be, you're always on the spot. You always need to. So it's a different scale. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know, mixing it up in the kitchen.
Yeah. What have you found the biggest struggle with Honey & Co, with running your own thing? Or obstacle, perhaps?
I think maybe... I mean, we've been very lucky. We're not going to complain about anything, really. We've been extremely lucky. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes you do have things that you want to achieve and time limitations, or someone gets sick, or, you know, suddenly a neighbor complains because you guys were too noisy last night, and you'll get a 1 o'clock phone call saying, hey, you guys are still playing music while they're cleaning the kitchen. I want to go to sleep. So there are things like that which you can try as much as you want to not have, but they always happen. But other than that...
Yeah, I'd say... Because the work itself is very fun. It's the things that stop the work or that put it in threat. That's really stressful and really not enjoyable. Like, you know, you'd say... Like neighbors or landlords or council, all these things that are sort of outside our little bubble.
Mm.
This I find stressful and unenjoyable. But this is, you know, true for everything in life.
Mm. Exactly. And in terms of the creative process, obviously you've got two books that have come out now, which have both done phenomenally well. How long was the process of writing the books, and did you write them together? How did it work?
Well, in a way, it was kind of one book that we split into two.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we started writing, we collected everything. We realized that we wouldn't be able to put all the baking and all the sweet stuff into the same book. It would just be too long and a bit too boring for people. So we kind of split them, and the first one is all about the journey of opening a restaurant and kind of the journey of through a meal. So how you would start a meal and the main courses. And it's very much about the food and the background of what we did. And it was really easy to do because we started hiring chefs, and we had to write down the recipes once we were not the ones cooking in the kitchen. And all we did was then translate them to smaller quantities for our home. And with the beautiful writing, most of it Itamar does. So all the stories and all of that is Itamar. I do most of the boring numbers of weights in the recipes themselves.
Meticulous recipe testing.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's a good collaborative kind of thing. And the first one was very easy and flowed very easily because really we were just recording as we were going. That first year, and it took a year to do.
Which no one would believe us that it's going to take a year. They're all going to say, oh, yeah, it's going to take 2 years.
No. We rushed through it.
Yeah.
No. And the second one was harder work, because baking is harder work, because you have to test and double test, and you have to assume there's a few different ovens and everyone reacts slightly differently. So we tested it in quite a lot of different ways. But it was nice. It was a different kind of...
Yeah, and then the baking book sort of more follows... Because if the first book was more setting up the restaurant and the beginning of it, then the baking book was more about the culture of the restaurant and the people, you know, our staff, our regulars,
how the
rhythm of the day in the restaurant, which is... I don't know how interesting it is for people who read it, but for us it was really nice to have these mementos of really a great period in our lives.
Mm.
Yeah.
With Middle Eastern food, I mean, you discussed that the Yemeni girls come and visit and they taste things that remind them of home. Do you think if you haven't ever been to the Middle East that you can have the same connection to the kind of food you create? Do you think there's been a shift in essentially Middle Eastern food and our perceptions of it?
I think you connect to something that is comforting and is homey. You connect to it regardless of the country it's made in. So you can have like a really nice ramen soup in Japan and think, wow, this is really comforting. You don't need to know the scope of flavors. You don't need to completely understand everything that goes into it. It still creates that same feeling.
Can you cook it without being in Japan and trying it? Well, can you cook it well?
Can I cook it well?
Like
no,
one?
But if a grandmother in Japan does, then...
No, but like someone who...
With a good book, I'm sure you can.
Okay.
No?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know.
We just don't try, but I'm sure you
no,
can.
No, but I think, you know, for Julia, our head chef, who's Polish, who's an amazing chef, and when she started working with us, we'd always say, oh, you put more lemon.
Yes,
you know,
don't make the food
needs,
too Polish.
Yeah, it needs to have more herbs in it. It needs to have more... you need to have more cumin in it. You know, we'd always sort of amp it up a little bit. And that's, you know, I think the sensibility, because we know the food from home.
We do, but people that eat it, does it matter whether you know the food or not to enjoy it?
No, not if you eat it, no, but if you cook it, yeah. If you need to cook it, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you need to cook it for a living, doubly so. I think.
I think Middle Eastern...
I think we forgot the question.
I think...
Sorry, yeah.
No, it was
exactly that. It was whether you can have such a strong connection to it if you haven't grown up on it. For example, my boyfriend is Persian, and when he has tadig, when he has his crispy rice, he's so excited by it, and I try it. It's rice. Tastes nice, but it doesn't move me in the way that it moves him.
I think there are certain things...
And I'm glad
things...
he's not here because we'd be very embarrassed by that.
No, but there are certain things that we eat that when we've tried to put them on the menu, people do not get. So we make jakhnun, which is a very kind of Yemeni bread. You bake it overnight. It's rolled very thinly. It's quite a laborious kind of thing, and we get super excited when it's, you know, when it comes out of the oven or when we make it. And
our customers would be like, what is this?
Why are we eating this? Why is this bread so brown? Why is it, you know, why is it so dry and oily? But for us, that's an exciting thing. So things like that we've tried, some of them haven't lasted on the menu. There's a few things that people just don't, like, we don't get why this is a dish.
But do you not feel like perhaps you just should keep it on so that eventually they will eventually just come to understand and love it? Or do you think
we're not
possible?
An educational facility, you know. We want people come and enjoy.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a very immediate thing. You come hungry, you leave replete and happy. Or if you don't, we've not done our job. Mm-hmm. So we're not, you know, no one's paying us to teach them, or nor are we, you know, qualified to do it. Because again, like you said, it's a very personal thing. We always make sure that whatever is on the menu is whatever people enjoy, and if people don't enjoy it, we're not serving it.
No, but I think some things are universal. I've never given anyone a falafel that's just come out of the fryer, and they've said to me, no, I don't like falafel, I don't get it. Because even if they've never tasted it before, when it's fresh, when it's done well, when it's done with the right ingredients, they try it.
They like it.
It is empirically delicious. They're not like, I refuse to accept that it's not delicious. But some weird things like the crispy bits of the rice or the slightly burnt bits of the rice or a bread that's been baking for you know, 8 hours. Those are personal things. Mm. And it's the same in England. I mean, not everyone falls for black pudding. Yeah? Mm. Some people are like, oh my God, I'm never going to eat that. But other things everyone agrees are really nice.
Like Marmite.
And crumpets. Marmite is not a good example.
Yeah. If there was one dish that you would say was like that food that really moved you, what would it be?
That's
other than the bread.
Question.
Sorry.
What would move you?
Ftut.
Ftut?
Yeah, so really it's embarrassing. It's just kind of wet crackers that you...
Matzah.
You have with, yeah, matzah basically, that you mix it with warm butter and egg. And my grandmother used to make it for us for breakfast. That's my favorite food, hands down. But if I'd make it for anyone, they'd be like,
why is this food?
Why is this food? Yeah. But for me, that presses my button.
It's the things you grew up with.
Yeah. Oh, it has to be, you know. It's so connected to it. So.
My mother used to make a dish called special potatoes, which I learned in recent years is potatoes cooked in Heinz tomato soup that she used to put in the oven, and under the grill they were kind of caramelised, and I thought it was the most incredible dish.
Sounds
and recently
good.
She said, I said, what's the trick? She said, Heinz tomato soup. I was appalled, but I still love it. So.
It's these things, you know, it doesn't matter. If,
exactly.
If it presses your button, you know, it doesn't matter what goes in it.
Exactly.
But this sounds delicious, actually. I will.
Recession, deliciousness. So my last question...
You put
question,
cheese on it?
No. she put carrot. It's carrots and boiled potatoes covered in Heinz tomato soup under the grill. Honestly, it tastes delicious.
Sure,
I think
it
maybe it was some Marmite. She's made Marmite soup as well, which was Marmite.
I've tried...
it was an exciting childhood for me.
Pasta with Marmite.
Yeah.
Have you tried it?
Yeah, there's a Jamie Oliver recipe.
There's a Nigella recipe I got it from. It's really good.
It's very nice. Yeah. Simple goodness.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to come to the end soon because we're going to open it to the floor. So my last question really is, to what extent you can tell us what your plans are. What can we kind of hope for Honey & Co the next year and you guys as a duo?
Okay, we are busy. We have taken a little shop across the road that we're going to open a little sort of grocery store in. It's going to be like a little deli. It's going to be super cute. And simultaneously, we are also opening a restaurant on Great Portland Street that's going to be a grill. And it's all happening together now. We didn't mean it to, but it just happens like this, and it's horrible. But also wonderful and great fun, but really stressful.
So the shop opposite Honey & Co, what's that going to sell?
We're going to sell, you know, fruit and vegetables that we get, because you get really nice stuff. You're going to sell, you know, dry store like pulses and things like that. all the stuff that Said makes, the jams and cookies and all these things. Cookbooks that we like, wine.
Just like a foodie. Just a foodie kind
of
shop.
Yeah, just kind of the kind of shop we want to have close to home. But
for other
people's home. Yeah. But maybe one day we'll open one in Stockholm. Yeah. Not right now. And then the restaurant is going to be what Honey & Co. was supposed to be.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be a grill house,
mm-hmm.
Middle Eastern grill house. But we couldn't do it because we didn't have the kit for it. And now we do, and we are. So that's another sort of dream.
Fantastic. So a meat. So it's
going to
be meat focused.
No, not necessarily.
Not necessarily. It would be fire focused.
Yeah, grill focused.
A
lot of vegetables and fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah, meat and fish as well. Everything. It's nice. Again, very traditional stuff.
And my real last question would be: when people leave Honey & Co. and in future when they leave the grill restaurant, what would you like them to feel?
That they want to come back. They want to come back, and that they had, you know, and we can see it. And there's sort of, it's very, it's a very specific experience that you'd go into a restaurant, you go into a situation that actually is quite intimate. You know, you're being fed, you're being looked after, you know, your needs are being taken care of, and you may have, you know, you can go into a restaurant, you know, you've had this day or that, but the idea is that you leave, that you feel that you're being looked after, you know, you've been fed well, you've been, you know, treated with kindness and hospitality, and you want to come back again because this is, you know, a nice thing in mm-hmm. your life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anything? No?
No. Yeah. I think for us that would probably be the biggest challenge, is to keep it personal versus something else. So we're 5 minutes walk from all of them, so hopefully we can by that manage to keep it quite personal. That's our main goal, I think.
That's it. It's very exciting. Any more cookbooks?
No, we write the column. That's quite a bit of work. Maybe one day it will all be collected together, but for now we have our hands.
People are not together. I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Come around. So I'm going to open to any questions we have on the floor. If anyone would like to put their hands up, anything they'd like to ask.
Hi.
Hello. We love your place. The only problem is getting a seat.
Yeah, now we're working on it.
So my question is, where do you go to eat?
Okay, we go to the Canton Arms in Stockwell, where you live, which is a terrific restaurant. It's exactly the kind of place that you want to have close to home, because the food is so delicious, it's not expensive, you can always usually find room. It's excellent British pub food, really good. We go when we feel splurgy to Rocca on Charlotte Street.
Mm.
Well, that's, you know, a bit of a hit on the pocket, but it's worth it completely every time. And tonight we're going to Café Murano.
Are we?
Yeah. Yeah. After the thing.
After the ceremony.
Yeah. But there's so many great places to eat in London. The main problem is that there's never room anywhere, is there?
In the good places,
you can't. You can have so many different meals in London, but the good places, you're crying. You know, you can never get a table.
Well, nice to hear you're opening up.
Yeah. We're hoping to solve that problem, or at least, you know, make a dent in it.
When you guys set up your restaurant in Warrington, did you guys expect that? Obviously, you wanted your restaurant to do well, but did you expect that you both would become such a kind of brand of celebrities in a sense? Was that expected?
So not.
No.
The
we
books
don't,
weren't expected.
Yeah.
I don't think any of it was in the plan at all.
No, and I don't, and I, we don't see it as work in a way. I think it's a kind of, you know, whatever small claim to fame we have, it's a byproduct. We like to think of what we do, or our main work, which is stuffing food in people's faces.
And our own.
And our own.
Time, yeah. No, I think it was very very surprising, and I don't think we thought about it too well. We could have maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, and I don't think that's actually what we're going to do the rest of it. I think, you know, next year no one's going to remember who we are, and we'll be back in our kitchen. We're not hoping, God forbid, but we're
fly on the radar.
Yeah, we're happy. We're enjoying every minute of everything. It's great fun. You know, we get to travel. They send us all over England.
We finally got to see the UK a bit.
Yeah, we went to Scotland. They send us here. They send us there. It's terrific. And we do terrific. You know, we do fun stuff like this. And not to rub it in, but it's great fun. But it's not our career. Yeah.
Other questions?
Do you write the FT column together, or?
Yeah, we usually. Well, what we try and do is, as our menu changes, then the dishes that are very successful and have worked, we try and make a home version of them. And then we'll discuss kind of why we ever put the dish on or what's happened since and if there's any story related to it. But usually everything is related to your life. So, like, the next column is about... Oh, no, it's the one after. But because we've just moved flat. So it's just about something you would cook as soon as you move into a new flat. So it's all about this. It's kind of just following our life. So it's quite a nice...
Do you read it?
Yes, I do, and it's absolutely lovely. You were writing about the blue, but the bowl which you had in your hole, which you used to throw
everything in.
That was a lovely story.
But it's all true. This is it's just things that happen. So I think he has a very nice way with words. So he puts I tell him a very boring story, and and he can make it very nice. And sometimes I'll try and write something, and he'll just delete it all and say, wow. Like, what are you, five? And then this is kind of how it goes. But it's I know he's here and he shouldn't listen to me saying anything good about him, but he has a very good way of writing about what's going on in our life. So it's a nice way for us to record everything.
Yeah, and actually these columns, the EFT, is of all the things that we do, we're crazy about it. We love it so much. It's so nice to see it, you know, every week or every other week in the paper, and to get that immediate reaction and to have, you know, to always be in that process. It's really, really fun. Because the book are, you know, once you hand them in, it's done. You know, it's final, it is what it is, it's a set object. And then this is a kind of open conversation and a process, and it's just tremendous fun. It's really, really great. We enjoy it thoroughly. No? Yeah.
There's a question at the back, yeah.
Oh, thanks. Well, I just wanted to add that with somebody like myself with a visual arts background, I still think of aesthetics and taste to do with food, and that's why I devour and adore the kind of food that you make, because it's like a work of art on a plate, and it's the idea that you also bring in flavours. And I just wondered about spices and herbs, because I remember the first time I tried satay, is it, and sumac transformed the hummus, and I thought, what is this? This is amazing. And how do those kind of ingredients, herbs and spices, affect you? Do you try things, you know, like add a dash of this, or how does it work for you?
I think there are certain things that we always use because they're like our...
Sort of go-tos.
They're our salt and pepper, yeah? So when we grew up, even when I say I grew up in quite an English home, there was always za'atar, there was always sumac, and there was always smoky paprika. It's just kind of part of...
Yeah, or our chefs will always joke and say... Well, we had this dish on the menu, but we don't put pomegranates and pistachios and mint on it. Wait, did you forget, or is it just? But this is kind of the flavors that.
And the olive oil, and it's kind of the flavors we use. We don't go around tasting new flavors and saying, "Ooh, what's the next thing we can spice up our food with?" We pretty much use the same kind of pantry. Pantry is the word. Pantry of ingredients, just in different ways, and what. We try and do is use kind of the best fruit in season and see what works with it. So we'll taste something,
or vegetables.
We'll taste something together and we'll say, this is really missing something. It's missing some depth or some earthiness or some real freshness or zing. And then we'll work with those same ingredients to try and achieve that. But they don't change, those base ingredients. They're pretty much the same. No? It's not an innovative food. It's just...
Yeah, it's just what it is.
There's another question at the back.
It might kind of relate in terms of the visual aspects. I mean, as chefs, how do you think that social media has changed how we sort of eat food? I guess food's always been something that people have enjoyed as a group, and now people are wanting to kind of widen that up and take pictures of their food and share it with people who often they don't know. Do you find in your restaurant that people kind of take photos and What's your thoughts on that?
It's a good one. It's a good one because we thought, you know, even in our head, we'd say, when we opened Honey & Co., we said, we want to be a kind of a neighborhood place or sort of a place for the people around or the community. And then very quickly, we've realized that the community that we operate in is not sort of geographically the people that are close to us, but the people that are interested in this kind of food or in food in general. And these are the people that will serve. And we've, you know, I'm an Instagram addict. I love it. And I just love this kind of interaction. And I love the fact that you can have a conversation with someone that you don't know over something that you have in common, which you'd say, you know, this looks great, I want to eat it. And this is, in a way, it is the common denominator. It's what we all have in common. We all, you know, we all eat, in a way. So I think it's tremendous. I think it's a great thing. Yeah, and I'm an addict.
Some of your dishes have become iconic because of Instagram. If you look up Honey & Co., because I know this because I also Instagram my granola there every time I go, and the cheesecake is the most photogenic cheesecake in London, I think, yeah. Because it is, everyone's always snapping at there.
It's also not bad to eat.
It's delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually the same plate in plastic would be the picture and next one.
But is this something you increasingly think about when you're designing dishes?
No,
you don't.
No,
really?
No. The only thing,
because I feel like a lot of people do this. I mean, I've done Instagram consultancy, so I know people do, where you literally have to look at it and say, would it do well on Instagram? So it's not something you actually think about when you're designing it. Is it just primarily taste first?
No, it needs to look nice because it needs to look nice. The food does look nice, you know. It's the nice things, you know, beautiful tomatoes, artichokes. These things, they look nice, you know. You don't need to do a lot. Or cakes, you know, everybody likes cakes.
Your cakes look nice, I'm not sure about mine.
Your cakes look nice, you know, cakes are nice. You know, it's sugar, it's what's wrong, you know, what can go wrong? We think about the food looking nice and being pleasing to all senses. But we don't, you know, sit around and sometimes we do.
It's gone cold.
Yeah.
Were there any more questions at all? Okay.
Final question.
Yeah, sure.
Because we've spoken obviously about London and changing tastes here, and I was just wondering whether what's going on in Israel. Whether I know, you know, you go to Tel Aviv and you can get sushi and all kinds of things, and I was just wondering whether in your lifetime you've witnessed huge changes to what Israeli food means.
I mean, the food has changed the humongous. I mean, it's crazy. When we mostly left because there wasn't a food scene, there was what people ate at home, which was delicious. There was a food scene, yes, you're right, a food scene, but not a restaurant scene. So people would eat at home, and the food at home would be very nice, but you would go out to horrible restaurants where you would get a jar, you know, like a bucket of food.
Pasta,
like a kilo of pasta with a kind of really rich sauce that was not very nice.
It was dreadful.
And that's what we grew up eating. It was horrible food, where kind of the Italian trend came in, but it was completely misinterpreted. And now, it's all about the fresh produce. It's about a lot of pride in using very local ingredients, a lot of pride in kind of making it look beautiful for, you know, for social media and other reasons. And the whole restaurant scene has just exploded there with really, really good food and people that are passionate about trying to kind of create something that is unique. Because it's a new country, I think for a long time it had no identity. But a lot of Asian foods come in. So sushi, ramen and Thai food, they're huge in Israel as well.
Yeah, and I think in a way across the world, because I think, you know, when I was a kid, say you'd go out to a restaurant, if you'd go like once a month and it would be like a thing, you know, it would be like a treat.
Once a month is a lot.
Yeah, and it was a lot, you know, for, you know, my parents would take us out and we'd have like, you'd go to the steakhouse, it would be like, wow. But then, you know, these days people eat, you know, you eat out three nights a week. And that sort of happens, not in all of Israel, but in Tel Aviv and a little bit in Jerusalem, there's that scene. So I think it grows with the changing of the crowd. People are not sort of looking into their own kitchen, but into sort of a public kitchen, a restaurant.
What do you think's made the Israeli restaurant scene take off in that way?
I think there's a lot more money in Israel now.
Yeah.
money and people have less time to cook. I think a lot of this food was very labor intensive.
Yeah.
And people just don't have the time. They work a lot and they have quite a few kids still, everyone. And you go out to eat because it's easier.
Yeah, and you've been to Tel Aviv. It's a very affluent town now.
Yeah.
It never used to be or wasn't.
But
quite
a lot of people
much.
Have moved there, so it's kind of
yeah.
And you get foreign, you know.
It's foreign money, and there's money there now.
Mm.
And people, you know, they're just like in any boom town, you know, people are partying.
Mm.
So yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank